They say there's a direct correlation in the time of a presentation between the introduction and the actual presentation. Thank you. So it's about, you know, 10 times as long as the introduction should be the speech, right? After such a wonderful, elaborate introduction by Rabbi Einbinder. Really setting the scene of this important time and day of Gimel Tammuz. I think I have quite a long soliloquous presentation that I'll need to present to you today, which should last about 2.5 hours. Which isn't such a problem, because I'm reminded of the story of the rabbi who was very popular. Not because he spoke well, but because he spoke brief. Every one of his speeches was exactly 12 minutes and nobody ever complained, which is quite an achievement. And one day the community was so happy with him, they bought him a beautiful house. It was a little bit far from the shul, but it was a beautiful house. He settled into the house, and from that day on, every Shabbos, every Saturday, he's giving 45, 50 minute sermons. And people said, what happened to you? We loved you at the 12 minute, you were the 12 minute sermon rabbi. He said, listen, I used to live 12 minutes away from the shul, so on my way there, I thought 12 minutes, I came up with a sermon. Now I'm 50 minutes away, so now it's a 50 minute sermon. Took me about 30 hours to get here from Cape Town, so settle down. But I do want to very much acknowledge the Einbinders, my former mentor and friend Rabbi Green, who's a mentor of mine in Yeshiva in Seattle, going back almost 40 years, and all the other shluchim who are in the valley here in California and have set the stage and the possibility for us to fabring, to connect, and to grow on this Gimel Tammuz. When the story of the Jewish people in our modern era will be written, the 20th and 21st centuries, there's no doubt that the Rebbe and his shluchim and the enterprise of shlichus will be at the absolute center point of that story. But what I know is that within that story, sitting here in the valley, is very much the crucible, very much the birthplace of that incredible story of shlichus. To us shluchim, who are a little bit a generation after Rabbi Einbinder, I'm sorry to rub that in. He wanted to know which generation for Rabbi Yossel Weinberg I was. For us who grew up, actually grew up on the West Coast in Vancouver, on shlichus, spent a year here apprenticing in California in 40 years ago, exactly in 1996. 30 years ago, thank you. And seeing the work of Chabad of the Valley in particular, seeing the work led by Rabbi Josh Gordon of blessed memory, who truly trailblazed pathways of shlichus, of community strength and growth, of faith in a future that was sometimes bleak. I came here 30 years ago to visit, and Rabbi Einbinder and Rabbi Josh Olav HaShalom gave me a tour of this magnificent center. I said to Rabbi Green, do you still have the same carpets? I remember the carpets. Some people say, sadly we do, but for me, it's been an incredible trigger of a time of hope and positivity when we really did not know how we would go forward. This was just after Gimel Tammuz. So to be here and to speak and to spend time with you on this Gimel Tammuz is for me almost coming a full circle. And I know that what we can gather, the strength from this Gimel Tammuz, we can take forward and ultimately fulfill the mission that each one of us is here for, to bring the world of Malchus Shin Dalet Yud under the dominion and kingdom of God, to bring Mashiach. May we experience that speedily in our time. Amen. Amen. fellow goes to his therapist. He's quite anxious, which is usually why people end up at a therapist. He's quite agitated, and he says, "You got to help me out. This is really, I got a problem here. You got to really take care of me. I'm not doing well. I've got this God complex. Every night I can't sleep. I think about how to run the world. The next morning I'm worried because the entire weight of the world is on me. You got to help me. Guys, therapist says, slow down. Settle down on the couch. Why don't you start from the beginning?" The fellow says, "In the beginning, I created the heavens and the earth." I want to begin from the end. I want to take us to a moment after Moshe Rabbeinu leads the Jewish people out of Egypt through a split sea into a wilderness where they end up spending 40 years. He leads them, as he says in his own words, like a mother would carry her child in the bosom, faithfully, dedicated, completely übergegeben to this Jewish people, to bring them to the promised land. And a tragic moment before his passing, when he knows he's not going to make it to that land. He's going to pass away in the wilderness. And God says, "I want you to climb up the mountain of Nebo," which would ultimately be his resting place. "And then I want you to look." God shows him the entire length and breadth of Israel, both in space and in time, from every single facet of that land. He peers at it. And God says to him these words, "Hariticha, I have shown it to you, v'shama lo yisaver," but you will not cross over into that land. And every biblical scholar says, what's going on here? Is God trying to rub it in? Is he mocking and taunting Moshe? Moshe has faithfully led the people. Not only is he not allowed to go in, but he's got to look at it, and he's pointed out you won't make it, so why look at it? Why take him and schlep him up a mountain and give him the power and the vision to see every single length and breadth of the land? To what purpose is this? And the great biblical scholar, the Italian sage, the Sforno, says something very powerful. He says, you got to understand the influence of a tzaddik. A tzaddik doesn't just see something. Re'ias tzaddik poel. The look of a tzaddik creates the reality. And even though Moshe Rabbeinu is not going to enter into the land of Israel, it is necessary for Moses to see the land, to look at it with his eyes, with his unique Rebbe lenses of Moshe Rabbeinu. And through this, to give credence to the sanctity of the land of Israel. It is only through the power of Moshe Rabbeinu's look that the Jewish people were able to enter and have an eternal relation with this land. I was thinking about this recently when I was considering, I'm just going to take a pause for a moment and ask everybody to put their phones on silent. I was thinking about it because I was going back to a little bit of my own beginning in considering this anniversary of the Rebbe's passing and my own relationship with the Rebbe, which really was already generated in the womb. My parents dedicated to shlichus. My grandfather, as you heard already, being an emissary of the Rebbe for many years. And I was reminded of a moment that has often come back to me in my journey with the Rebbe. Going back to about 1990, I was a 16-year-old, and it was my first Tishrei at the Rebbe. Grew up in Vancouver. We grew up with the Rebbe in every fiber of our being. I recall every Saturday night, the Rabbi Einbinder was so well connected to this, running after Shabbos before we went home to call New York. What was Shabbos like? Was there a Fabringen? What did the Rebbe say? What happened? We lived every fiber. We were the Rebbe's shluchim in Vancouver. But I didn't spend much time with the Rebbe. And now as a 16-year-old, I had the opportunity to spend the entire season of the high holidays with the Rebbe. Rosh Hashanah, to stand close and hear the Rebbe cry out the words before Shofar. And hear the Rebbe sound the Shofar. Watch every movement. The Rebbe was a magnet. Everybody was glued to every movement, to every single nuance of the Rebbe's worship. But you know, unlike this beautiful hall, which has nicely arrayed seats, 770, by the way, anybody who says we're organized religion, go spend a day in 770. We're not such organized religion. But 770, especially in that time, was almost seatless because it was standing room only for about 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people. And everybody had a spot which was theirs. You're talking about a 2x4 space, which they've had for decades. And I show up, I want to see, I want to be close. How do you get close? Everybody's got a claim on a little their spot, their mokim kavua. So I hit upon a plan. You heard about my grandfather for Rabbi Einbinder. My grandfather also was the cantor by the Rebbe. He led the Musaf services on the high holidays, as well as ushering in the high holidays with the first night of Slichos on the Saturday night before Rosh Hashanah. And my grandfather was getting on in years, and I arranged for Yom Kippur to be my grandfather's helper. You have to understand that the front of the shul in 770 was barricaded, but I'm talking about barricaded because the pressure was incredible. And in that front space, the shvil was blocked off for the Rebbe's secretaries, some of the very great leaders of the movement, the Rebbe's chief of staff, Rabbi Chodak of Avraham memory. They stood in this space. It was really freed of the crowds. And there on Yom Kippur of 1990, David Weinberg's got a spot. Because I had to help my grandfather. After all, he was getting on in years. You bow down at certain points in the service. How is he supposed to get himself up without moving his feet? The Kohanim would pressure against them as they climbed, hundreds of them, to bless the people at the end of the services. And so I created a little bit of a bridge to block a protective space so that they wouldn't, crush him in the crush of the Kohanim. And here's, so you take a space in the back. Sitting in a milk crate. It's a sparse open area. And there I'm sitting. And my grandma, anonymously, as much out of the scene as possible. Low down so that I don't block anybody's view. But I've got a great front row, okay? Great front row. And then my grandfather's doing the kairim. He's bowing down, recalling how everybody would prostrate themselves when they heard God's name being uttered by the high priest. It was a great moment that he's chanting, and the Rebbe would do his own personal prostration before, and then he would turn and watch the chazan. Physically turn and watch. As my Zayde chanted this particular melody. And then suddenly something caught his eye. There was a movement he wasn't used to. And he turned. And there, about 10 feet behind, I was sitting in a milk crate against the table, which served as the barricade, which was chained with metal, big chains, to make sure that the press of the people didn't actually break this barricade. And there I was against it. And the Rebbe took a look. Now you have to understand, when I landed here in Los Angeles about 1 a.m. this morning, I hear shrieks. Some celebrity, some pop star lady was getting her luggage, and some other people recognized her. They ran over, they took pictures, autographs. It was big excitement. You see, you're a hero, you run over. Let me tell you something. By the Rebbe, you didn't want to show your face. The Rebbe had such a majesty. He was such an awesome experience. You know, the Rebbe, when he looked at you, he didn't look at you. He looked right through you. He saw everything about you, no less a personality than Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, one of the great philosophers of our time, proclaimed that when you stood in front of the Rebbe, you knew he knew every single thing about you. Which teenager wants the Rebbe to know everything about you? Not such a good idea. Which chassid, half worth anything, wants to push themselves around there? We used to run away from a look. But I had nowhere to hide. I was 16 years old, completely naked as the Rebbe stared at me. I had nowhere to go. I had nobody to hide behind. I was sitting on this milk crate, and the Rebbe's looking, and looking, and looking. And that look never left me. When I saw that Sforno, when I saw how the Sforno explains Moshe Rabbeinu's look, the power of a tzaddik, I realized the Rebbe wasn't just looking at me, through me. The Rebbe was creating something. The Rebbe's look motivates. The Rebbe's look empowers. The Rebbe's look demands. He was creating something. And I've often wondered to myself, am I living up to that look? The Rebbe's look created worlds. And today, for a few minutes, I want to try and look through the Rebbe's eyes. I want to try so that we can think for a moment, how did the Rebbe see things? What was his unique perspective, as we heard from Rabbi Einbinder, the incredible achievements of raising a generation after the Holocaust, of changing the landscape of Jewry in the world so absolutely. What were the Rebbe's look? Because like Moses, the Rebbe's eyes, it's heaven's eyes. How do you look at the world through heaven's eyes? So let's go back to the beginning. You know, we say in the Amidah, bless you, God, Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoteinu, our Father and the God of our fathers. And why do we say that? Why can't we just say, bless you, our Father, or say, bless you, God, the God of our fathers? Now, there's two stages in our relationship with God. When you grow up, when you're little, we all innocently, instinctively believe in Hashem. But He is the God of our fathers, of our parents. It's a lens and a relationship that is formed and defined by others. But every one of us has to wake up at some point. Every one of us has to grow up and develop our own relationship. Elokeinu, my God. He's our God. It's my relationship. And that's ultimately what we have to actually grow into. I grew up in a relationship with the Rebbe that was born, as you heard. Third generation, chassid, devoted, determined to try and fulfill the Rebbe's will, to give nachas to the Rebbe. But at some point you've got to grow up. And at some point you've got to have your own relationship. I want to tell you the moment that I felt that I became the Rebbe's chassid. It was in 1995. I was spending a year in South Africa. By the way, join Chabad and see the world. So I was in South Africa for a year then, which eventually led to a lifelong commitment to Jewry in South Africa. And I became very close with a fellow by the name of Koppel Bacher of blessed memory, who my grandfather in 1955 had schlepped on one of his annual trips to South Africa, had inspired his father to send him to yeshiva in New York in 1955. And Koppel became a very devoted chassid of the Rebbe in a time when Lubavitch was fledgling in America. It was tiny. It was intimate. You knocked on the Rebbe's door and you went in. There were a couple dozen people in shul. So I said to Koppel, we were sitting once on a Friday night, I said, Koppel, tell me some of the stories. What was it like growing up at that time? What was the Rebbe like when he was so young? He was in his 50s. What was it like? He said, I'll tell you a story. He was not a man of many words, Koppel. He said, I'll tell you a story. It was 1 year Erev Yom Kippur. So we're talking about the late 1950s. And everybody's in a frenzy getting ready for Yom Kippur. There's multiple meals to have. In Chabad, we go to the mikveh 3 times. There's tshuva to do. There's kaparis. There's a whole day. You got to get your seat ready. You got to get yourself ready, spiritually as well. It's a big day. Just try and imagine for a moment, what is it like for the Rebbe preparing for this awesome day of the high holidays of Yom Kippur? Wow. Right? Wow. I mean, what holy things is he doing in the most intense way possible? Suddenly, a couple is told that he's being summoned by the Rebbe's chief of staff, Rabbi Chodakov, to his little office in the second floor of 770, or the ground floor, if you look at it from there. And he doesn't know what he did wrong. He's a teenager in the yeshiva. Why on Erev Yom Kippur would the Rebbe's chief of staff need him? What's he done wrong? He feels like he's being called to the principal's office. He goes outside, and Rabbi Chodakov says to him, unceremoniously, because that was his style, I was just in the Rebbe's room, and the Rebbe said to me that Koppel Bacher has an aunt in New Jersey, and her husband just recently passed away. She's going to be feeling very lonely. I should make sure that Koppel should call her to wish her a good year, wish her a good year and well over the fast, because she shouldn't feel so lonely. When you're looking through heaven's eyes, you don't see a vast landscape. You don't suddenly experience this look as if you're looking over from the space shuttle at this incredible blue sphere. When you're looking through heaven's eyes, as you're preparing for the most awesome day of Yom Kippur, The Rebbe notices one solitary elderly lady in New Jersey and knows there's a way to make her happy and feel connected on Yom Kippur and for a new year, make sure that couple gives her a call to wish her a good year. My friends, that's the day I became a chassid. That's the day I realized what it's all about. This isn't simply about global activities with dramatic statements. This is about the ability to zoom in on every individual. That's how heaven sees things. And this was reinforced to me by a story that my grandfather told me. A story that is well known in the circles of Chabad. My grandfather in his travels didn't only travel to South Africa and South America and Central America, he also traveled through Central United States. And in his journeys, he became very close with a family in Ames, Iowa, a prominent businessman, a Jewish fellow who became so close to the Rebbe, he didn't do a thing without the Rebbe. And one night, my Zayda was called late at night by this fellow. They need a desperate blessing from the Rebbe. There's a medical thing, and they will not make a move without the Rebbe's guidance. Please, can you go over to, it's like 2 a.m. Please, can you go over to 770 and ask the Rebbe for a bracha? Because surely the Rebbe's awake at 2 a.m, which is indeed true. Probably still working, indeed true. So my grandfather rushes over to 770. It was a night of Yechidus. 3 nights a week, from 8 p.m. until the list concluded, the Rebbe conducted private audiences. Often that would go on till 3, 4, 5, even 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes it went till 10 o'clock in the morning straight. And so this night, my grandfather rushed over. It was a Yechidus night. He rushed over to 770. But the Rebbe had already concluded the evening's meetings. And he was secluded with his chief of staff, Rabbi Chodakov, in their room. And he was preparing to leave to go home for the day. My grandfather didn't have the chutzpah to knock on the door or disturb the Rebbe. But he needed to get this message urgently. So he wrote quickly a note, which is usually how he communicated with the Rebbe, precise, concise, and effective. And he took the note, he put it into the door jamb of the Rebbe's office, figuring the Rebbe's secretary would open the door, see the note, and present it to the Rebbe for advice. But that's not what happened. Even though my grandfather got advice that night from the Rebbe, an answer to the question. The next day, Rabbi Chodakov rebuked my Zayde. He said, you know, you caused the Rebbe to be inconvenienced. I said, what? It's the last thing I would ever want to do. He says, the Rebbe opened the door himself. The paper fell down from the door jamb, and the Rebbe had to pick it up. This, my grandfather was mortified. A chassid devotes every opportunity to making it easier for the Rebbe, more comfortable spiritually and physically. To inconvenience the Rebbe to bend down and pick up a paper was not in his agenda. He was mortified and he wrote a letter of apology to the Rebbe for having caused the Rebbe, Uftzah ibn Atzettel, that he had to lift up this note. The Rebbe responded with a few words that were so beautiful. And in it, the Rebbe revealed what is his unique mission as Rebbe. The Rebbe circled the word Uftzah ibn to lift up. And the Rebbe wrote, but this is my entire purpose, more than purpose, this is what I'm about, is to lift up others, especially that which others overlook. Because the secretary didn't see the note, he picked up the note. Especially that which other people overlook. My friends, today we come together for Gimel Tammuz, and we all want to connect to this incredible soul, this incredible energy, this incredible light of the Rebbe. And here is a simple, direct idea. If the Rebbe's life, which continues into Chaim Nitzchem and into an internal energy and life source, till today, is all about seeking to lift up something that's overlooked by others, how easy is it for us to connect to that, to see something that is overlooked and just lift it up? The Rebbe didn't only lift up individuals, an elderly lady in New Jersey, or whoever it may be, a Jew in Ames, Iowa, who needs a bracha at 3 a.m. The Rebbe lifted communities. I don't know, is there anybody here from South Africa? Anybody here? We love you, man. You are mulaleka. That's it. Bayachut. We know firsthand, I'm not going to elaborate this evening, maybe at the Fabring in a little bit, I've got some great stories nobody knows. But we know firsthand how the Rebbe lifted up South Africa and insisted that people should not be afraid during very turbulent times, made incredible efforts by sending emissary after emissary, shliach after shliach, to continue strengthening the community, which till today is truly a guide of the Jewish world. But listen to a story of how the Rebbe lifted up a distant community. Ephraim Halevi is a former head of the Mossad. I don't have to explain to you, I don't have to translate Mossad, right? There was an Israeli living in New Jersey who asked the rabbi there, Echom rim b'ivrit, how do you say in Hebrew, tikkun olam? We know. It's in the English lexicon, right? The Mossad. Ephraim Halevi was the head of Mossad. And I think he's still around. An incredibly distinguished leader and intelligent and a leader of great worth and value. Ephraim Halevi, before he became head of the Mossad, was the deputy head of the Mossad in charge of the diaspora desk in the early 80s. And at that time, the PLO was evicted from Lebanon and Tunisia allowed them to settle in there in Tunisia. The PLO moved to Tunisia. And in that move, the Mossad determined that Tunisia was now going rogue. They were joining the militant Islam groups. And it was dangerous for the future of the Jewish community, a community that's been around since the first temple. Community of Kohanim. A very ancient community. It was time for them to move because it was going to become dangerous and unstable, untenable for the Jews of Tunisia. So they sent agents to quietly come into the community, start talking to some of the leaders, explaining to them the dangers and helping them to assist for the community to make a mass aliyah and move to Israel. And they were very successful initially. They spoke to people, people were very receptive, appreciated the help, the support, the concern. But then suddenly these very same people started coming back and deciding not to go. They said, why not? Well, Rabbi Pinson said it's not necessary. So he goes to Rabbi Pinson, the Rebbe's emissary there from the 50s, I believe. Rabbi Pinson, why do you say they shouldn't go? I write to the Rebbe. He says, I work for the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I asked the Rebbe. I said, the Mossad is here, Israel's here, encouraging people to make aliyah. It's dangerous. I asked the Rebbe what we should do. The Rebbe said, there's nothing to worry about. So I've told people, because they want to know, what does the Rebbe say? So I've told people, the Rebbe says there's nothing to worry about, so they're not moving. So Ephraim Halevi is sent by the Mossad to have a personal private meeting with the Rebbe in 1982, 83, to meet with the Rebbe to persuade him to allow the Jews of Tunisia to make Aliyah and to move to Israel. And he describes this in an interview, what it was like for him to come. He's a secular person, but it comes from a Lithuanian background. He meets the Rebbe, and he's very confident that he'll convince his rabbi, with all his intelligence, with all the background, with all the resources, that he should let the Jews go. I mean, it's nice of you to play a power play with the Mossad, but you know, it comes to an end. And he meets with the Rebbe, and he's shocked to learn that the Rebbe actually is standing his ground. And he says to the Rebbe, but we have intelligence sources, and the Rebbe says, I also have sources. And he says he understood from the Rebbe that the Rebbe had very good sources in the State Department, in the American government, and other places, and the Rebbe was relying on real intelligence, and he did not believe that the Tunisian government was going to go radical. They were not radicalizing, even though they let the PLO in. And the Rebbe said to Ephraim Halevi, you have one of the oldest communities in the world, and before you shut down a community, you have to be very certain that it's necessary. I'm not convinced it's necessary to close the lights on the Tunisian Jewish community. So they're staying. And they did. And the Rebbe was right. Tunisia never radicalized with everything going on there. It's never radicalized till today. The Rebbe saved that community because a little lonely community was ultimately the Rebbe's responsibility too. And I want to say to each one of you here tonight, you have spent often decades in various communities in the valley. You've seen the power of smaller communities fledgling as they grow and then they stabilize and then maybe people start to move on to other areas. Natural migration happens and some people are still holding on. We're still doing our thing. The Rebbe didn't send the shluchim to be the holdouts of communities. He sent the shluchim to be the vanguards of Jewish communities. And each one of you, partners, together with the shluchim in your communities, are the roots of a community, not the last ends of communities. You are the future, because when Mashiach comes, every one of your communities, and with the roots and all, are going to spring up, are going to fly together and be included within the Holy Land together as a community. And it's because you, each one of you here, has committed yourselves to being a part of that community, that you have created not just simply a proud past, but an absolutely fabulous future. So yishar koach to each one of you for that. And please God, may we experience that future today, mamish now. Let's look for a moment at how the Rebbe worries in Torah, because the Rebbe was a giant of Torah. For the little guy, let's learn a little bit of the Rebbe's Torah together. We'll focus on this week's Parsha. Everybody heard of Korach? Familiar with the guy? A rotten egg. Korach is a malcontent, born into prestige in a noble Levite family, first cousin of Moses, a great scholar, and a man of immense wealth. He's unhappy. Moshe Rabbeinu becomes the leader. He nominates his brother as the high priest. His younger cousin becomes the head of the tribe, and Korach is left in the dark, left out in the wind. He's not getting any covet. He's not getting his rightful place. So Korach goes on an unsuccessful mutiny against Moshe to destroy the whole Jewish project. Let's understand the nefarious character of Korach. Because Korach demands and claims that Moses is the one who's deciding that Aaron should be the high priest. He's not speaking the word of God. This is power plays going on here. He read Robert Greene's 48 Laws of Power and he's doing them all. What do you think you are? Unfortunately for Korach, he didn't read the book, but that's another story. And my friends, what Korach sets out to do is literally undermine the Jewish project at its infancy. Because if Moshe is not speaking the word of God, what's the Torah? It is a fundamental article of faith, as Rambam Maimonides declares, that Moses is the father of the prophets and every word he teaches in the Torah is God's word. Without that, there is no Judaism, because Torah is at the heart of our identity as Jews. And so Korach seeks to undermine it for a little bit of covet, a little bit of success. Moshe tries to dissuade him unsuccessfully, and his end is bitter indeed. He's swallowed up together with his family and colleagues, and they are swallowed up in the earth alive. Nobody likes Korach. The Torah itself says don't be like Korach. The Torah itself, the Mishnah declares that you should not, that the epitome, the paradigm of a dispute is Korach. But you think the Rebbe gave up on Korach? No. The Rebbe gave up on nobody. The Rebbe looks at Korach, he says, wait a second, if the guy is such an evil guy, how come we call the Parsha Korach? Here's a very important prism of the Rebbe's principle of Torah. If Jews refer to the Parsha as Korach, what are you going to call a Parsha Hitler? What are you going to call a Parsha? You're not going to take a terrible person and simply refer to the Parsha by that? You couldn't find a better name? If Jews are calling this Parsha Korach, it means there's something of incredible redeemed value within Korach. And indeed the Rebbe then proceeds with his great erudition and genius to explain to us that within Korach lies a very beautiful motivation. Korach claims and looks for essentially DEI, equality, egalitarianism. He wants equality. Didn't we all stand at Sinai equally? Didn't we all hear and experience God's revelation at Sinai? Why should there be a hierarchy, a high priest, and then a Moses, and then a Levite, and then this one? And we're all connected. We're all part of the Jewish project. We all have equal access. Within Korach lies an incredible desire to bring himself and every Jew even closer to God. The way he went about it was wrong. He was deeply misguided. He veered from the path of Moses. Very dangerous. But Korach, in his heart, there is a spark of yearning to be closer to God. You see how suddenly this evil person We discover there's something deep inside that we can learn from as well. This is Karach. And indeed, the Rebbe's approach to picking up everything that somebody else would overlook was beautifully exemplified when the Rebbe took on a project of helping Jewish prisoners and encouraged Shluchim to take notice of Jewish prisoners. They were in prison for tzaddis. They didn't behave very well. But prison should not be about retribution, it should be about rehabilitation. And so the Rebbe made an effort and called out that everybody should make an effort to reach a prisoner and lift them up a little bit more. Give them a little hope. Reveal the spark of goodness in them. Beautiful story from South Africa that I heard from the members of the family. The chief rabbi of Pretoria for many years was Rabbi Shapsi Katz, a Jew from Eastern Europe, came to South Africa and successfully built up a wonderful connections in the capital in Pretoria. And was the chief chaplain of the army, chief chaplain of prisons, chief rabbi of the capital city of Pretoria, and a man very devoted to the Rebbe. Every year would come in December, the South African summer, he'd meet the Rebbe, they'd have an audience, they go through issues, he'd get guidance. One year he comes to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe says to him, Rabbi Katz, we've been talking about prisoners. It's almost Hanukkah. The Rebbe was being a little understated. Hanukkah was tomorrow night, the next night. The Rebbe says, you know, on Hanukkah, when you light candles, there's an incredible inspiration that comes from a little bit of light, physical and spiritual. Do prisoners in South Africa light candles? Rabbi Katz said they don't, but it's a beautiful idea. When I get back to South Africa, I will speak to the powers that be, and I will make sure that we can implement that prisoners should light candles. So the Rebbe said, but what about this year? He says, it's about 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. In South Africa, it's 6 hours ahead. Tomorrow night is Hanukkah. How's he supposed to get this thing? He looks shocked. He says, but I can't call General Sefton at 4 a.m. And by the way, we have South Africans here, you'll bear me out. If you call somebody after 9 p.m., you're in trouble. You can't call anybody at 4 a.m. He'll throw me out. It'll be counterproductive. The Rebbe said, no. The Rebbe rejected that. On the contrary, said the Rebbe, when you call from America and you say that you actually want to help somebody from America, you call him at 4 a.m, he'll be impressed. Long story short, Rabbi Katz went, he called the secretary, went to the office, got the Rolodex, got the general's number. By 11 o'clock, it's now 5 a.m, he's calling with his heart in his mouth, he's calling a South African general, General Sefton, the chief of prisons. The man answers the phone, he says, it's Rabbi Katz, I'm calling you from New York. What's wrong, Rabbi Katz? What happened? He says, well, I was just by my rabbi, and he's worried about the prisoners, the Jewish prisoners, because tonight's Hanukkah, and he would like them to light candles. He says, your rabbi in America is worrying about a Jewish prisoner in South Africa? That's incredible. He said, yeah. And he asked me if you could do something. He says, you got it. Tell your students they can go to the prisons that have permission to light candles. So the next morning, the Rebbe comes out to davening, and there's Rabbi Katz beaming. He says to the Rebbe, mission accomplished. So the Rebbe says, after davening, can you come see me in my office? So he comes into the office, and the Rebbe says, there are 50 states in the United States. 49 states allow candles to be lit by prisoners on Hanukkah. Would you believe it, says the Rebbe, the one state that will not allow Jewish prisoners is the state of New York, the most Jewish state in the Union. He says, they won't allow it. Rabbi Katz is sitting there, like, what am I supposed to do about that, you know? He says, go across the street to Rabbi J.J. Hecht. Rabbi J.J. Hecht has great connections in the New York Police Department, so on. From the mayor and everybody. He'll know what to do. So Rabbi Katz goes across the street. He's got a mission from the Rebbe. He meets Rabbi Hecht. Rabbi Hecht, I came from the Rebbe, yeah? The Rebbe wants you to make sure that they have candles because South Africa, they're allowing it. We should allow it. Our Rebbe, says Rabbi Hecht in his inimitable way, it's Xmas today. Where am I going to find somebody in the afternoon who's going to help? Well, what do you think? He called up. He told them in South Africa they're letting candles. South Africa was a pariah state. The head of prison says in South Africa they're going to allow it. We're going to allow it. By Mincha, he's standing by beaming. The Rebbe comes out for Mincha. He says, mission accomplished. The Rebbe says, do you mind coming to my office afterwards? He comes in. He's wondering, what's next? Indonesia. The Rebbe says to him, you've done me a great favor. What can I do for you? Rabbi Katz was very moved. He got very emotional. He says, Rebbe, you give me everything. You're always there for me. Every blessing in my life I feel has come through you. There's nothing else I need. There's nothing else you need to do. I mean, the Rebbe said, nevertheless, I'd like to give you something. He said, look, I'm going to go home. I have to bring a gift to my son, Michael. If I can have a Tanya that is autographed by the Rebbe, it'll mean a lot to my son. Rebbe said, after Meyer, there will be a Tanya waiting for you with my signature. And so Rabbi Michael Katz, who today is a shliach in Ilova, Johannesburg, has a signed, autographed Tanya by the Lubavitcher Rebbe as a personal thank you. The Rebbe left nobody out. The Rebbe lifted everybody. Let's finish with the beginning. Moshe Rabbeinu goes up the mountain, creates the land of Israel with his vision, and then eventually passes away. And the Torah declares, "V'lo yoda ish es kvaros ad hayom hazeh." His burial place is concealed from us until this day. Despite the fact that it's triangulated, the Torah gives us great references where it is. If you ever go to Israel and the tour guide says to you, I can show you where Moses is buried, don't believe him. Get a refund. The Torah declares we don't know where it is. And indeed, we don't know where it is until today. Why is this important? So one of the commentators beautifully explains that Moses is so vital, so alive, so present. We don't talk about Moshe Rabbeinu Olav HaShalom, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, some past. We learn Torah Moshe every day. Moshe Emes V'Torah Toemet. Moses is true and his Torah is true. Moshe is vital and present to go looking for a burial place. Nobody can find the burial because he's still alive. He's still present. He's still vital with us. But I say to you, my friends, that with the Rebbe, in a way, it's almost the opposite. The whole world knows where the Rebbe is interred. The whole world knows an address 32 years after Gimel Tammuz. After a moment when the world went dark and was confusing. And we had no idea how to go forward. And with which koyach. I remember my sister called me. She was a teenager and studying in Australia, an older girl. She said, how am I ever going to get married? You got married with the bracha of the Rebbe. Today you see a cemetery, you don't see a cemetery. You see a place of engagements. Every day there's four or five people getting engaged, couples getting engaged, coming out of the Rebbe's resting place, beaming, smiling, everybody singing and dancing. What is that? It is alive, it is vital, it is present. The world knows an address and knows that if you want to connect to the Rebbe, you either go there physically or you send a note there or you give it to your local shliach who's going. There is a place and an environment where the Rebbe continues to bring blessing and guidance to the Jewish world. Whether it's Donald Trump, who ended up there before for blessings, or Cory Booker, go whatever side you're on. We're equal opportunities here. Or Lahavdil hostages, whose families came and pled for blessing. And when those hostages were miraculously released, many of them, they personally came to give acknowledgement to God's miracles that came through a blessing of the Rebbe at the Ohel. My friends, 32 years later, I can't experience Gimel Tammuz as the sad day I experienced it 32 years later. Because every year the Rebbe becomes more relevant in the world, not only the Jewish world. And every year his message becomes more transported and more effective. Let me finish with one story. Not long ago, my daughter finished high school and went off for a gap year in Israel. It's a very exciting moment. It's a moment of a lot of hope. It's a moment of growth. It's a great milestone. And we expected a wonderful year for her in many, many respects. But a very short while after she ended up there, it was clear that this was not for her, and she came home. And to be honest, I'm a positive guy. When I go to the Rebbe for a bracha, I sort of figure out how it should work out. I just need the Rebbe to push it through. You got the solutions, you know? You've got it. You know, something will work out. I flew to the Kinnis HaShluchim that year. I had no idea what this child was going to do. It's middle of a year now. The year's already started. What is this person going to do now for the rest of the year? This was not part of the plan. This isn't how we had scheduled it and played it out. I didn't have a solution. So I went early one morning and I poured out my heart into a letter. I read it in front of the Rebbe and I really said, look, I don't know what to do. But you know the Rebbe, this is your child. This is your shlucha in Cape Town. Do something. I have no solution. After a couple hours of connecting and learning and praying and beseeching, I left the oil. I called home in South Africa, and my wife's sounding pretty chirpy. I say, well, why are you sounding so happy? She says, because our daughter, she says, she's going to Iceland. I said, what, Iceland? What are you talking about? She says, yeah. I called up a friend of mine who's a shluch in Sweden. She has a winter camp, but she doesn't need any help. She said her daughter in Iceland needs help. So my daughter called up this woman in Iceland. She actually needed help. She's on a plane tonight to Iceland. Now, this is literally how quickly this happened. I said, that's crazy. What is in Iceland? What's she going to do there? She's going to be alone there. It's like, what can there possibly be in Iceland? So my wife calls up the shlucha. She says, look, this is really incredible. My husband went this morning to the oil. We had no way forward. And suddenly I said, but what is it about? She says, you think you had a story? She says, let me tell you my story. Says the shlucha in Iceland. She says, Sarah, I've been looking for help for my children for 3 months. I'm desperate. I have found nobody suitable to come. This morning I called my mom. I said, Ma, I don't know what to do. There's one girl ready to come from Israel. She doesn't speak a word of English. My kids don't speak Hebrew. Maybe they speak Icelandic, but not Hebrew. I don't know what to do. So my mother said, I'm in New York with your father for the Kinnas HaShluchim. I'll go to the oil. Guess what? Leah Namdar and I were in the oil at the exact same time. By the time I came out, my wife had this idea to call Leah, and the whole thing was already organized. She went in to say, my daughter needs help in Iceland. I went in to say, I need a bracha for my daughter. And the Rebbe said, okay, I'll sort it out for you. My friends, we have a Rebbe. The Rebbe guides us. He gives us life. He gives us purpose. And he gives us the blessings we need in our life. And so, when somebody once asked the Rebbe, who was not religious, he said, how can I be your chassid? The Rebbe said to him, if tomorrow morning you wake up, and you say, I want to be a little bit better than I was yesterday, that person I'm proud to call my chassid. Every one of us here can take the energy of Gimel Tammuz, can take the relationship that we have with the Rebbe and through his shluchim. Every one of us here can get up and say, I can be a little bit better than tomorrow. Every one of us here can heal a faribul. South Africans, you can translate for the rest of the valley. You can heal a dispute. You can look at somebody who's not noticed and overlooked and lift them up. You can be a little bit better, a little bit more, a little bit stronger tomorrow than you are today. And we are all his chassidim. And with him, with our communities, we will all end up, together with the Rebbe, with Mashiach, immediately in the Holy Land. L'chaim.